Welcome to the Phil Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:49 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. It's March 19th. Today, my eldest daughter is 15 years old. It feels like yesterday when she was born, but it's been an interesting 15 years. We can go back and think about what's happened in the bond markets in all that time. Back in 2006, we had interest rates that were happily trading above the 4% level. And as recently as a year ago, we had yields that bottomed around 30 basis points. That's a pretty profound move in the course of 15 years. And now we've had a meaningful pop on the upside with yields. I really am startled, and I think it's very interesting just how emotional the bond markets tend to be. We can think about all of the storied investors on the macro front, those people who are looked on as the masters of the universe in the bond market and whose prognostications are viewed as practically prophetic. And then we can think about just how do people tend to react to activity in the bond market. Because back in 2018, it was very tempting to think that we were about to embark upon a secular bear market in bonds, and that this move above the 3% level was the beginning of a new uptrend, and that it was going to cause all kinds of problems for the US government, for the Federal Reserve, that there was going to be a calamity in terms of the bond markets. And it didn't happen. And we had this incredible compression in yields. I think it's also then worth considering what were people saying back in February and March of 2020. The clearest conclusion was that we were going to have a generational long period of deflation, and that it was not going to end, there was no end in sight, that we could be in this kind of deflationary environment indefinitely, and the only thing to own were bonds. And today there's a headline on Bloomberg. I wonder if it's still there, but it was to the effect that the bond bull market is over. There we go. Treasury's bull market that began in 1981 has finally ended. Well, that's a rather interesting turn of events, because when we were thinking a year ago, there was a lot of people thought that the only possible route for yields was into negative territory. And now we're looking at people beginning to think that the bond bull market has in fact ended. Well, we've had a very meaningful move in yields, and it's having a material impact on how people view the market. There are a lot of very interesting things that are happening in the bond markets right now, and obviously we can definitely think about this incredible trend of compression in yields since the peak in 1981, and it's a desirable question to begin to think about: what will it look like when this trend does eventually end? I think that it will end eventually. That, I think, is the most important thing to point out. And then we can also think about the fact that total return investors will have to start really losing money in order to really signal that this trend is over. And we've had a meaningful move lower in the total return index over the course of this year alone. So we're now well below the trend mean. We haven't had a pullback like this since the end of 2016. And subsequent to that, we had a meaningful rally. And it did push back above the trend mean. We also had another decline after that. So in order to truly confirm that we are at the end of this bull market, well, we're going to have to see a rebound back towards the peak and resistance encountered in the region of the trend mean, and subsequently a sustained move to new lows. there are legitimate reasons for thinking why we would be thinking or why there could be an end to this bull market. But in order for there to be an end, well, we would definitely have to see a committed change of strategy from central banks, because central banks have facilitated a massive amount of liquidity and debt issuance over the course of the last 40 years. And as yields have compressed, the quantity of debt has multiplied, so that the stimulus package that the USA has just embarked upon is 8% of GDP. That makes a nonsense of just trying to close the output gap. It's way in excess of the output gap, and it means that they have a great desire to run the economy hot. And you had Jay Powell this week saying that the Federal Reserve is not going to intervene. They're not going to raise rates. They're going to proceed upon their prescribed path, and liquidity is going to continue to remain abundant, and they want inflation to trend higher, and they're nowhere near a point where they can conclude that it is trending higher. So there are two important points here. The first is that the Federal Reserve and other central banks have given up on predicting inflation because they're horrendously bad at it. They have been predicting inflation would take off for the last 12 years. It didn't. The quantity of money that's been printed wasn't enough. And now we're into more of, so there's been a major strategy shift. This is no longer simply about combined monetary stimulus, but rather that we're looking at synchronized fiscal stimulus with synchronized monetary stimulus. So there is a lot of money flowing out into the system. And that's certainly a change, because it's designed to create inflation. And they're going to keep at it until they get inflation. Then there are idiosyncrasies to the bond market that are certainly pushing yields higher in here right now. So bond yields were up another point and a half in here today. It's certainly looking oversold. So it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we might get a pause of consolidation. But in the first quarter, the US Treasury is expecting to issue a lot more debt than the Federal Reserve is willing to buy or is planning to buy. And that throws the onus for responsibility to absorb all of that additional supply onto the private sector and the institutional sector. And institutions are unaccustomed to having to fess up and support the market. So they are demanding a higher yield, which is why yields have moved in such a dynamic manner over a very short period of time. And yields are likely to continue to trend higher until it reaches a point where the yield is desirable enough that it will compensate investors for the risk they're taking on, or until the Federal Reserve panics and begins to introduce additional stimulative measures by buying the bonds. But then we have the additional point that if we look at 3-month bills, they have negative yields now. And this is a repercussion of the new stimulus package. So if we just then think about when was the last time we had negative yields? Well, we're going to have to go back and look a really long time, because there hasn't been any real sustained move below negative since 2008. Certainly we've seen occasions in the past when they've bumbled along around the 0%, but the stabs below 0% have been much more exaggerated in the course of the last year. So there's a lot of demand for short-term paper. Now, how do you hedge yourself against the potential for rising interest rates? The Federal Reserve has said they're not going to raise rates, and The bond market is selling off rather aggressively because there isn't enough of demand for the bonds. Something will eventually break. And at the other side of the bond market, in the very short term area, then the US Treasury is pulling down a huge amount of money out of the Federal Reserve, $1 trillion, sending it out into the economy. It's looking for a home in terms of deposits. The Federal Reserve has said to the banks that they need to increase their leverage ratios, which means they need to hold more assets. And that means they either need to go out and accumulate assets, or they need to reduce their liabilities. So they're bumping up against their leverage ratios, which means that something needed to be done. The Federal Reserve has said that they will absorb an additional, I think it's something like $40 billion worth of reverse repos. So it's really going to be a round trip between the one side of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet and the other, and it'll just circulate through the economy and back to the Fed if that's the case. But that's the exact opposite of what the desired result for all of that money is supposed to be. So it's increasingly likely that a great deal of it is going to be saved. But it creates demand for short-term paper, and which is, of course, why we have contracting yields at the short end and expanding yields at the long end. So when we then think about the spread between the 10-year and the 3-month, well, it is now trending higher in a rather dynamic manner. And it's highly cyclical. So we can also think about the fact that when it becomes negative, it's because liquidity conditions are tightening up. It's also a lead indicator for a recession. We've had the recession. But generally, recessions last longer than 2 quarters. And on this occasion, we've had a sharp drawdown and a sharp reversal. So there is a temptation to think that this extremely sharp rebound in the yield curve spread is in large part because of anticipation that growth is going to take off. And it could easily take off because there is a great deal of pent-up demand among consumers. And people are queuing left and right to get themselves vaccinated, and that is likely to persist for most of the rest of the year. Some countries are going to be vaccinated much faster than others. They're going to get back into their normal lives a lot faster. And I think anyone who's predicting that we will never again have a normal life again simply doesn't understand human psychology. We're going to fall back into our normal routines a lot faster than most people give credence to. One thing that I can certainly see is that traffic is picking up around Los Angeles. So as the number of people who have vaccinations is increasing, so are the number of people traveling around. Offices are opening up. Restaurants are opening up. People are booking holidays. People are thinking about the first sports event or concert they're going to attend. And all of that is going to require money. And it means that a lot of the spending that people have been delaying is going to start coming back into the economy. And that's going to create demand for everything. So what the Federal Reserve predicted this week was that growth was going to be outsized in 2021, that we're going to have a very sharp rebound. I think that there was a lot of talk about a K-shaped recovery back during the presidential election. What I think is potentially possible is that we might have a K-shaped recovery, but it's going to be different arms of the economy are in different arms of the K. Because when we look at this very significant advance, and that is the wrong ticker, this extremely impressive advance in the cloud computing sector in 2020. The number I've seen thrown around is that they did 3 years worth of business in 1 year. And that's eerily similar to the kind of headlines that were circulating the market in 1999 because people were fearful of Y2K. Well, there was an equal fear in 2020 that businesses wouldn't be able to function, so they absolutely needed to invest and invest quickly in the cloud computing sector in order to sustain their business models. And that was a one-time boost to their business models. It does raise the question, where are the sales going to come from in 2021 when everybody bought what they needed in 2020? Because realistically, if one avoided migrating onto the cloud in 2020, well, then you're probably going to need a lot more convincing to do it now that we're coming out the other end of the pandemic. Of course, it's an assumption that we are coming out the other end of the pandemic. We know that a number of areas in Europe are looking at additional waves, and Europe in particular has failed to secure the number of vaccines that would be required to immunize the entire population, and they also spent less on developing new ones. That was a double failure on behalf of Europe. And it suggests that they are going to have to engage in a lot of additional monetary and fiscal stimulus to sustain the economy. And I think that's what the stock market is pricing in. So the Euro Stoxx index did push on to new high ground over the course of the last week or two, and it's now testing the peaks from back in 2007. But we have to look at lots more history to really get an idea of how lengthy this range is. Now, one thing that is, I think, particularly relevant here is yield curve spreads are rising everywhere. It's not simply in the USA. So this is a global phenomenon. The Japanese yield curve spread has been bumbling along above zero, and it's in the process of potentially now breaking out on the upside. And Japan is at the beginning of thinking about how they are going to come out of their yield curve control system. And if Japan is willing to begin to think about how to exit yield curve control, then they are probably thinking that inflation really is starting to make a comeback. And there is probably no country in the world who would benefit more from a return to an inflationary bias. We can also think about some of the commodity producers. So the Canadian yield curve is surging higher in line with the USA and rapidly approaching this 200 basis point level. It's usually around the 200 basis point area where we start to see these spreads turning over. I think the rather interesting phenomenon in this recovery is that the stock market pulled back in the early portion and then rebounded much faster than we've seen in other cycles. So generally, when we think about the pop on the upside in the yield curve, it generally coincides with stock market weakness. And on this occasion, we haven't had the weakness. The Australian spread is already back in the region of the peaks from over the last almost 30 years. So it would be unusual for this spread to continue to march higher. But in order for it to stop marching higher, well, we're probably going to have to see interest rates rise. And Australia is in no position to raise interest rates at present. We can, that's the US one. The Swiss yield curve spread hasn't quite broken its downtrend yet, but it is certainly rebounding. And it's a similar condition for the UK spread, where we've definitely seen a pop higher in the spread over the course of the last year, but it is only now at the beginning of breaking its downtrend. And then, of course, we have Germany, where we can see that this sequence of lower rally highs has been broken. This looks like a type 2 bottom with massive reaction against the prevailing trend. It would suggest that the lows are also in terms of the German yield curve. So all of that is telling us that there is upward pressure on yields at the long end of the curve everywhere. And it's representative of not simply the lack of demand for those bonds, but also for perceptions of economic growth. And one thing we all know is that valuations are pretty full, and we are at a point where there is a significant rotation underway, because the Nasdaq is representative of the growth side of the market. But it's also populated by some of the largest companies in the world with some of the strongest balance sheets. The price, however, has now put in a lower high, and it came back to the region of the trend mean and bounced. And it's going to absolutely have to hold the region of the trend mean if the upside is to be given the benefit of the doubt. As interest rates rise, it puts pressure on all companies that rely on cheap sources of funding. And there's plenty of those in the Nasdaq, and perhaps the largest is Tesla. Tesla is 100% dependent on access to cheap liquidity. They have been unique in their ability to raise money at an extraordinary valuation and continue to do so repeatedly. And they went to the market on a number of occasions successfully in 2020 to raise additional capital. It's a company that benefits from regulatory arbitrage, and that is certainly true with the continued pressure that we see to increase carbon credits. And the carbon credit market is completely politically motivated, so it is continuing to push on the upside. And we're at significant new highs. This is perhaps the biggest counter-argument to why we would have a secular bull market in oil. And I will come back to that in a moment, because it's going to be pretty much instrumental in the question about whether we're going to have immediate inflation. We've a lot of activity going on in the bond markets, and what it is adding up to is steeper yield curves. And steeper yield curves, on the one hand, can be viewed as a return to growth. But in practice, what we've historically seen is the reason that the yield curve surges higher after an inversion is because of the panicky response that central banks have to the beginning of a recession. So they cut interest rates much faster because they didn't see the recession coming, and then they have to act in an aggressive manner to contain it. And on this occasion, they acted much faster than they have in other cycles. So there is the potential that what we're seeing now is much more an interpretation of growth rather than panic from central banks. Eventually, though, we are going to get to a point where interest rates will begin to rise, and that will happen in response to a robust economic recovery. But of course, then it brings forward the question about what to do about all the debt, because the quantity of debt has multiplied in the space of the last couple of years. And that is particularly relevant for the USA, because after Donald Trump became the president and they engaged in this massive fiscal stimulus, that they went into the pandemic crisis with massive deficits, and they're coming out of the crisis with even larger deficits. So that is likely to take a toll on the dollar. Now, the dollar index has rebounded to test the region of the trend mean, and it pulled back in here this week. I don't think we're going to see the dollar break down in a dynamic manner until inflationary pressures are clear. And the one thing that it has to its favor is the outsized yield, because you can't get 1.5% in a developed market and with a reasonably steady currency. And there's still ample demand for dollars around the world. But if we continue to see these measures to massively increase and further increase the deficit, there's just no way that the dollar is going to hold its purchasing power. And that brings us back to what we can see with the cloud computing sector, and then most acutely in the innovation sector. So the ARK Innovation ETF was a darling of the market over the course of 2020, and it went up in a pretty much a straight line. And now we've had a substantial pullback, and we had a rebound from the region of the trend mean. We've had some weakness over the last couple of days, and the natural proclivity of investors will be to buy the dip, and we still have evidence of them buying the dip. And I think in order to truly confirm that this is dip buying, we're going to have to see a higher high, and we don't have it yet. So we definitely had some steadier action in here today, and it's worth reminding ourselves that today was quadruple witching, so a lot of options expired in here today, and that's a catalytic moment for people to make a decision about whether they want to close out their trades or roll them forward. So we do tend to get pauses in the market around quadruple witching, but the bigger determination will be what happens in here next week. Then when we look at some of the big name companies, Nvidia has been one of the best performers over 2020, all the way up to its peak in August. Then we had a failed upside break in February. Then we had a failed downside break in March, and it's popped back above the trend mean. Now it steadied in the region of the trend mean and the $500 area in here today, and that level really has to hold. And it does still look a little touch and go for these companies that peaked in August and have been going sideways since. Amazon is another one. It's been hovering here around the 3,000 level for the last few weeks. It is still below its trend mean. Exploded on the upside in early 2020, and it is prone to the occasional range. So we're really at the touch and go moment. If bond yields continue higher from here, well, then that is going to continue to put pressure on capital-hungry businesses. And it is the most capital-hungry businesses are most likely to experience stress. So Netflix is another one of these companies where we've had a significant loss of momentum. We've had then this volatile ranging phase where the sequence of higher reaction lows has been sustained, but we are getting failed upside breaks. So this type of loss of momentum after a big pop on the upside, that's seldom a reliable continuation pattern. And it suggests that what we are looking at instead is potentially type 2 top formation and development. Completion of those types of moves would be massive reactions against their prevailing trends. So there is risk in some of these companies that are heavily dependent on access to additional liquidity. That's particularly true where there is an increasing source of competition coming through. And Netflix pioneered video streaming and has done incredibly well as a result, going from less than $10 back in 2012 to more than $500 is really a profound move. Well, now it's been so successful that there are plenty of people who are copying them. So that's obviously going to represent a challenge. And then we can think that, a much better capitalized company like Disney is also susceptible to some pause and consolidation, but they've gone from 0 to 100 million subscribers in their streaming service in less than a year. So That's a very significant success story, but it also speaks to the adoption of the subscription business model and the monetization of the walled garden that the company has in terms of the data that they can reap from their various other, I guess, properties. Now, then when we look at everything that's going on in the wider market, the subscription business model is really attractive because it streamlines cash flows and it makes forecasting more predictable and easy. And when companies adopt it, then they have tended to trend higher in a very consistent manner. And that was certainly true for Microsoft. They adopted the subscription business model back in 2015 and 16. We had a little bit of a wobble around as it was adopted, and then the share really hasn't looked back. But as interest rates rise, then it's going to put pressure on consumers. It's going to put pressure on these companies that are heavily influenced by interest rates. Some of the biggest buyers of cloud computing have been these companies with very little in the way of earnings. So that is the clear explanation for why Amazon looks like Netflix. It's not that it's not really about Amazon's retail network, which did exceptionally well in 2020, but more about the fact that there are thousands of companies with no profits, which spend most of their free cash flow on cloud services. And if those types of companies express stress in response to higher yields, well, it's going to feed through into the bottom line of some of these companies that supply the cloud infrastructure. So that's certainly going to be true of Microsoft, Amazon, and Google, because in many respects, they've been parasitic on the continued demand for cloud infrastructure. Then, the hottest sector over the course of the last 6 months have been the SPACs, and this has been a very marked loss of uptrend consistency. We had a very impressive advance, we had ranges one above another, and now it has pulled back, it has broken the sequence of higher reaction lows, we now have lower highs, and this looks like a rather dangerous environment overall. We have a lot more data for IPOs, and the IPO index accelerated in 2020. It's had a much larger pullback. It's a similar pullback in terms of size to what we saw during the pandemic. And now we've had something of a rebound, but it's very conditional on bond yields starting to moderate. And this, I think, is where we can look at, well, what's it going to take for the Federal Reserve to intervene? And I think we can then just go back and look at what happened in 2017 all the way through to the beginning of 2019. Sorry, I typed into the wrong box. 2017 was one of the most remarkable years ever in the stock market because it didn't pull back by more than 3% at any point in the entire year. And towards the end of the year, it accelerated. And that was a really incredibly impressive performance, and it was in large part due to this massive fiscal stimulus that was introduced by the Trump administration. So companies enjoyed this wonderful cut to their corporate taxes, the holiday on fees that might have been imposed from repatriating profits from overseas, and then there was an additional boost because regulations started to moderate as well. So investors spent the whole year pricing in that as a benefit. And In all that time, the Federal Reserve was engaged in quantitative tightening. So they were raising rates and at the same time were reducing the number of dollars in circulation by redeeming or refusing to reinvest the proceeds from the maturing bonds that they held. And the market didn't really pay much attention to it until Jay Powell was due to be inaugurated. So right after the accession of Jay Powell to the position of governor of the Fed, the market pulled back by 10%. And at that point, the Federal Reserve stopped raising rates. And the market pulled back to the trend mean, bounced and bobbled around a bit, and then started moving higher again. But it was then in around September that we had a very extreme liquidity problems in the repo market, and that started to wave signals that there were problems with liquidity, that the quantitative tightening program had probably gone a bit too far, and that it was going to cause a problem for people who need dollars. And that translated into a pullback. In all that time, they were persisting with their quantitative tightening program. So they were taking money out of the system. And then the market pulled back by 20%. And in 2018, right around Christmas, Steve Mnuchin met with the CEOs of the various banks, and they engineered a rebound. And at around the same time, we started to see that interest rates were coming back down. So right around, that it was in 2018, they continued to move higher. They stopped raising rates when the market pulled back aggressively. And by the middle of 2019, they were dropping those rates. So quantitative tightening and progression of higher raising rates a couple of times a year ended in response to a 20% pullback in the stock market. So let's just think then about now. What's going to be required for the Federal Reserve to amp up the number of bonds they're willing to buy, to clearly signal that they are going to ensure low borrowing costs for the US government and that they are going to support the bond market? Well, they're unlikely to act until we get a 20% pullback in the stock market. Well, the S&P 500 made a new all-time high on Wednesday, and we are 2 days down from the peak. So it's extraordinarily unlikely that the Federal Reserve is going to act now. The only other thing that could propel them to inject additional liquidity beyond the pace at which they are currently willing to do so would be a problem in the money markets. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility that this drawing down of $1 trillion from the Federal Reserve by the Treasury is going to pass off without a hitch, or that this increase in the liquidity requirements for the banks is also going to pass off without a hitch. So we have two, I think, competing narratives. The first is that we're in a growth environment and we've had a meaningful rebound in growth and that it is likely to persist. The other is that we're getting a lot of pressure coming to bear on the most over-levered part of the market because of those rising yields, and that sector in particular had benefited most from the conditions that prevailed during the pandemic. So at the very minimum, we are looking at a rotation. And that's what some of these ratios are telling us. So the Russell 2000 and small caps more generally have been outperforming in no uncertain terms. That is true in the USA, and it's also true in the UK, where the FTSE 250 has recouped all of the decline from the peak in 2020. In Germany, the DAX has broken out, and just this week, the DAX index also popped on the upside to make a new high. So the Mittelstand in Germany are also at a point where they are outperforming the wider market. Historically, smaller caps have tended to lead the market higher in Japan, and the TSE 2, our second section index, pulled back very violently in 2020. It now has surmounted the peak from back in early 2020, but it is larger caps have been doing better, and the Nikkei is pausing now in the region of this psychological 30,000 level. As I said, I think that Japan is rather well placed to benefit from a return to an inflationary bias. I think it is quite likely that we're going to have inflation. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be the same kind of inflation that people were really accustomed to or associated with the inflationary times of the 1970s. We had two different sources of inflation in the 1970s. The first was commodity price shock, with the oil embargoes and the massive moves that we had in oil at the time. A lot of consumers just associated high inflation with high energy prices. But the oil price is now pausing in the region of its peak from early 2020, and I think it is difficult to make the argument that we are in a secular bull market. I've certainly been reading a lot of the bullish commentary. There's a firm out of Texas, and I am going to fail to pronounce it correctly, but it's something to the effect of Goring, and I just can't pronounce the second name. And now I understand how people feel when they try to pronounce my name. But the reality is that what they're arguing is that there has been a lot of prime real estate already drilled in the USA, and that the supply growth is going to be impossible to repeat in the shale sector. And that is a legitimate concern. But we also know that shale oil and gas tends to be very elastic in terms of its response to price. And when we saw prices go down to $20, millions of gallons of oil, or millions of barrels of oil, were taken out of circulation. As we move higher in terms of prices, more of that oil will come back into the market. Then we also know that most of the offshore drilling companies went bust at some point over the course of the last decade. And Seadrill has been in and out of a bankruptcy, and then back in again, and then back out again. So it's not like the oil that these companies were drilling before suddenly disappeared. It's simply that it became too expensive. So as prices are sustained around the $60 area, more supply is going to come to market. I personally think that we have had this artificial environment where we've had an artificial supply disruption because of the pandemic, where ultra-low prices affected shale, and then OPEC also got together and said that they were going to curtail supply as well. And then we had artificial demand forecasts as well because of the rebound that's expected in the global economic activity. But the big challenge for the fossil fuel sector is going to be that continued trend higher in carbon credit costs, because it's politically motivated. And I think that there is a solid argument that we're not even close to peak regulation for the oil sector. So there's certainly going to be a lot of oil and fossil fuels and metals required to build out this green utopian future that the renewables are plotting out, but it's a potentially decades long infrastructure build, and as it progresses, the the oil sector in particular will be called on to pay for it. So this is obviously then going to create some difficulties in terms of the performance of the energy sector. And it is really only those companies that really act to, I think, control their exposure to regulation are going to prosper. Obviously, if it becomes more difficult to produce and the cost of production rises, well, then that should support oil prices. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we need to see them surging higher. Whereas, if we then think about, well, what was it that really did occur before the oil shocks in the 70s? It was debt monetization. And I think that that also points us towards where there's another sector that should do well as we move towards further debt monetization, and that's banks. And I think it is quite likely that we are close to peak regulation for the banking sector. So if we're thinking about, well, what is the transition going to look like, and what sectors will benefit as we move into a debt monetization fact? Well, banks will benefit because a sharper or a higher yield curve, steeper yield curve benefits their business model. And then they've already been able to design their businesses so that they can charge more fees. So that's not going to change either. Then they've certainly experienced over the last year where they haven't had to worry about the risk in their investments because they've been backstopped by the government. And we're starting to see that banking sectors everywhere are breaking on the upside. It's true of Europe, it's true of Japan, it's also true of the areas of the world where banks have been historically firm. The Australian banks, for example, have rebounded in emphatic fashion. Then we can think about the Canadian banks have broken on the upside and completed a lengthy range over the course of just the last 3 weeks. Now, we certainly have some short-term overbought conditions, but this is really quite impressive relative strength. And as we look at what the future holds and this progressive agenda that many countries are embracing, and the potential that it'll be a green government or a green-dominated government next takes over in Germany, that Europe in particular is going to go full-throated support for renewable energy, and it's going to need a lot of credit for that. So there is the potential, and this is, I think, also going to be true in the USA. One of the first actions that Joe Biden did when he became president was to cancel the Keystone Pipeline. So those are, I think, significant events. It means that there's going to be a lot of money spent on the green initiatives. Then there are millions of young people who are going to become progressively more important as electors, and their votes are going to demand more housing. And we had, I think, a rather interesting development in here this week with Lennar Homes popping on the upside, not because they're suddenly building more houses, but because their investments in technology companies are starting to pay off. And that's really a sign of the times. You can't get more brick and mortar than home builders, and yet that's not where they're making their money. And there is a shortage of affordable housing everywhere. So if governments are going to listen to the people that were protesting on the streets that want to achieve a better standard of living, and the demand for that is only likely to increase as a result of the experience from lockdowns during the pandemic, well, people will want to live their best lives. They're going to want to enjoy themselves. This attitude of you only live once is likely to prevail. And it means that there will have to be additional credit. And the credit multiplier that banks offer when they can make profits on the yield curve is exactly what's required. So unshackling the banking sector from onerous regulation is largely inevitable. It's going to be unpalatable politically at the beginning, and there's no evidence that it's starting just yet. But it does look to be something that is quite likely. And banks are already making money off a steeper yield curve, and they're likely to make more if the regulatory burden eases. Now, as we think about the other side of the market, the Bitcoin price is now right around the 58,000 level, but it is not pushing higher. So far, this is a consolidation in the region of the previous peak, but we haven't seen one of those before. In fact, we haven't seen a breakout fail and pull back into the underlying range in a year. We've had a sequence of higher reaction lows, and every single one of those breakouts has been sustained until at the middle of this month. So this is an inconsistency. And if we see the low taken out from Monday or the 16th, then we will be talking about a failed upside break and potentially top formation completion. So we're certainly in a more risky environment with the cryptocurrency markets than we have been for a year. There's the clear potential that cryptocurrencies are going to experience contagion because the same people who were buying Nvidia and Amazon, the ARK Innovation ETF, the SPACs, the IPOs, well, they're also buying Bitcoin. And it's susceptible to contagion because as the pressure mounts on some of those more speculative avenues, then they'll sell where they have profits, and where people have profits is in Bitcoin. So that could result in a rather swift pullback. And everything happens at an accelerated pace in the cryptocurrency sector. So that's certainly something that has stayed my hand in buying back into the cryptocurrency markets. And then we can also think about the fact that the Ethereum price has not pushed on to new high ground. And it did have a downside key reversal last week. We have not seen follow through, and the price remains steady. But it will absolutely need to sustain a move above 2,000 to reassess the potential that this could turn into a rather lengthy and potentially volatile environment for the cryptocurrency sector. And then it brings us to gold. Because gold prices have been steadying around the $1,700 area, but it's not a particularly convincing rebound. Certainly, we can look at the size of the downward dynamics since August, and that has certainly told us that when people want to sell, they're selling in size, and the number of people coming back to buy after those events has been relatively modest. So it's still a corrective phase overall. Now we know that the price paused at 1900, 1800, and 1700, and on each of those other occasions it rallied by at least $100. So that would suggest that a rally of at least $100 and back towards the $1800 area is more likely than not. It's after that, it's what happens will be the determining factor as to whether this corrective phase has in fact ended. I rather tend to think that there is certainly a correlation between the fact that gold and bond prices peaked in the same week. So people are selling because they're worried, that the negative real interest rate environment isn't going to prevail, and that the Federal Reserve will be forced to raise interest rates. I just don't believe that that is credible. But until we in fact see the Federal Reserve change its mind and begin to participate to support the bond market, then gold is likely to remain in a corrective phase. But it also means that once those kinds of events are announced, it will act as the next bullish catalyst, which could push it on to new all-time highs. So we've been in a corrective phase since August, and there isn't a great deal of evidence yet to suggest that this corrective phase is over, but it is looking increasingly likely that we are coming close to it, because we're starting to see stress coming through now in the most levered parts of the market. If we get additional weakness on Wall Street and other stock markets, then that will start to put pressure on central banks. And the higher the yield goes, the more likely it is that we're going to have that kind of action. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.